Welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. Based at the University of Manchester, we're Europe's largest research and teaching institute addressing poverty and inequality. Each episode, we'll bring you the latest thinking, insights, and debate in development studies.
This report is part of the Perspectives on Global Development series, which has been running for about a decade, since 2010. And this one is called Perspectives on Global Development from Protest to Progress, which hopefully gives you some kind of sense of what we were trying to achieve with the report. And there it is on your side. And there's also what is just a wonderful photograph of the unrest in Chile in 2019. And it's something we'll come back to later in this lecture. So the purpose of the report is to examine the causes and consequences of discontent and what can be done to alleviate it. Now, as Antonio says, it's a big report, and I'm going to focus more on the diagnosis than the response. I think this is where I'm on. Well, I think part of the message about the response is that it has to be, there is no particular, there's no clear answer to what has to be done. Responses have to evolve. However, on the diagnosis, I think I'm on slightly surer footing by providing you with evidence and also to propose a framework to you. The report was prompted by a surge in political instability since the global financial crisis, probably starting with the Arab Spring, which certainly attracted the development center's attention, because Tunisia was a country which had such strong, or stable at least, macroeconomic fundamentals, but suddenly there was this explosion of unrest which spread very quickly across the region, and arguably was one of the motivating factors behind the Occupy Wall Street protests, and then what has really continued to be, and I'll show you in a second what it looks like, a sort of a rise in political instability. And this actually continued in 2020 and in 2021, where we assumed, while putting the report together, that this surge that we saw in 2019, there were protests simultaneously across almost every Latin American country, for example. We assumed that this would in 2020 due to the COVID pandemic, but actually what happened is that the number of demonstrations still rose in that year, despite the fact that for 3 or 4 months or longer, in some cases, people were largely confined to their homes. And of course, it has continued in 2021 with some dramatic events at the start of the year in the United States and really continuing across the year. But what we aren't necessarily just looking at this kind of political instability, or rather, we wanted to look beyond it to a phenomenon that was perhaps both more easier to generalize, but perhaps harder to grasp. And so we hit on the idea of discontent, which we defined as a sort of collective frustration emerging from feelings of vulnerability, injustice, and unmet expectations. So it's already, we're starting from a term that is it's not immediately obvious to people what discontent means, but it was a way in which we could sort of enter this topic and address the kind of themes we wanted to. But you know, your thoughts on this topic, on this choice, would be most welcome. We saw evidence of this discontent in advanced and developing economies alike over the last decade. Of course, I've already mentioned the protests, the Arab Spring, the protests in Latin America, and in other parts of the developing world, there have been sort of large-scale protests over the past decade, continuing today. But at the same time, actually, when we started writing this, the real issue was populism in Western countries and sort of the emergence of ethno-nationalist parties and really a sort of perceived crisis in liberal democracy, which is obviously continuing to this day. So while we are predominantly thinking about developing countries here, we're also, a lot of the evidence in the report, a lot of the thinking comes from advanced economies as well. What we also posit is that the causes of discontent go beyond economic and material concerns. Discontent is a psychological and a sociological phenomenon with strong political dimensions, both national and also international. So we sort of barge into the realm of international relations, political science, sociology, psychology, anthropology. And as I said, you know, we don't necessarily have legitimacy in any or all of these spheres, but we wanted to sort of convey how complex this phenomenon is. But also, I think increasingly it's appreciated in academia, in organizations where we work as well, that you know, multidimensional approaches and you know, multidisciplinary approaches are increasingly key to understanding the complex challenges we confront. This report or this presentation today isn't going to be so much on COVID-19. It's somewhat retrospective, but COVID-19 was very much in our minds when we were writing it. And what the report tries to do is to explain how the how of building back better. So a lot of people have recognized that building back better means environmental policies, it means addressing inequality, it means various different policies, but beneath these are extremely complex political economy challenges, as Antonio mentioned. And really, we thought that by understanding discontent and helping policymakers perhaps to address it, this would enhance the chances of these changes actually taking hold and being effective. So as I say, today's presentation is going to be based around a series of key propositions or ideas. I don't necessarily expect you to buy them all, but I would be, I'm very interested in to discuss them. And I think these inform the report as a whole. So we argue that discontent has common causes and characteristics in different settings, and that it is thus possible to apply a general framework for understanding discontent, but not necessarily predicting it. That's, I think, a work for, well, the very complexity militates against any kind of prediction of what form discontent might take, when it might occur, and why, what might be the spark for it. We also argue that subjective well-being and social cohesion matter much more than we think. By we, I really mean typical discussions around development and economic policy, perhaps more broadly. We also think that discontent demands a rethink, not only about the journey, but also the destination of development. So our story starts around 1990, which is the sort of the high water, the end of the Cold War, the victory of liberal democracy as the model to export globally as a means of ensuring global stability and peace, but also the emergence of not market fundamentalism as we have today, but certainly belief in the importance of the value of markets as a key driver of development. We also argue that in developing countries, the sources of discontent correspond to traps, which is the development center, what we call these kind of structural bottlenecks to inclusive and sustainable growth. We also argue, and I won't really touch on this today because it's open to a whole new area, but the international dimensions of discontent are extensive and demand a rethink of global institutions. And finally, and this is a point I'll try and convey today, but I think is not necessarily easy in the time available. But I think one of the things that defines discontent in this area, in this era, and makes it such a concern is that societies are finding it difficult to address the cause of discontent because the basis for collective action is absent, and because it's increasingly clear we don't even agree on the nature of a problem, much less how to deal with it. And I'll come back to that point later. So first of all, allow me to make the case for discontent. And this is based on the kind of Albert Hirschman model of exit and voice, which your two options, if you're unhappy with the situation, either you leave or you express your voice and try and create change, and loyalty, which captures people's commitment to a particular cause or a particular system, and that'll influence their decision whether or not to leave or whether or not to express their voice. And this works for consumers, but it also works for countries. So it's a very neat model. And so voice, for voice, obviously, there's protests are the most obvious form of it, people taking to the streets and exercising their democratic right. So it's important to note that we don't necessarily see protests as anything abnormal. They're a part of a legitimate tool in a functioning democracy. There's no attempt to stigmatize protests. But nonetheless, we do see protests having a certain weight, a certain importance, and being indicative of a certain level of dissatisfaction, perhaps, with other democratic processes. And so what we see is a sharp rise in a number of protests globally from the global financial crisis onwards. And of course, it's a bit choppy, but there's a clear peak in 2015. And in all cases, there's been across all regions, there's been a sort of a noticeable trend upwards. But protests in and of themselves are an extremely well-studied field, and there's also different types of protests. So a very obvious distinction is the distinction between violent and non-violent protests. They are a different strategy. They're attempting to achieve a different result from the government, and they certainly pose the government with a different challenge. Just to give you a sense of how these trends might have changed in different regions. So here you have Africa and Asia Pacific. In Africa, you see on the left-hand side this sharp rise in protests over the last 30 years or so. But what you also see is an increasing number of protests being non-violent, or a higher proportion rather being non-violent than violent. Over this same period, there's been a shift away from political protest towards economic progress, the protest rather. So you see the nature of the protest is changing, and the conversation with the government is changing. And in some cases, that's a sign of a maturing of democracies in Africa. In Asia Pacific, on the other hand, there perhaps hasn't been such a sharp increase, but what there has been is there hasn't necessarily been a switch towards more peaceful forms of protest. The proportion of violent protests has increased. But as a footnote to that, actually Africa is the one region in 2020 where violent protests increased, violent political protests, and also the number of fatalities in these protests was also up, unlike any other place in the world. So that suggests perhaps a worrying reversal in Africa. Now, we've had voice. The other approach is, as I say, exit. So this is when you perhaps feel so disenchanted or disaffected with the political system that you simply, you step back, you don't vote. You decide that none of the parties offer you anything. You refuse really to exercise the basic democratic responsibility of casting your ballot. And we see there's this kind of long-term decline in elections or voter turnout rather across all regions, which is accelerated over the course of the 1980s. And it's not and continued to decline in the 2000s. It's not really a great advert for the third wave of democracy. And then we have loyalty. So loyalty suggests that that changes the calculus. To what extent are people going to protest, or are they going to opt out of the political system? Or maybe they'll just they have confidence in the government, so they'll see how this plays out. And what is very worrying in many parts of the world, most parts of the world indeed, apart from in Asia, is that there have been there's been a sharp decline in confidence in the government in the last 10 years or so, 10 years between 2006 and 2018. Now, because this is post-COVID, who knows how, these figures almost certainly will have changed, but I don't think we can necessarily be sure they'll have changed for the better. And there is certainly this reduction in trust and in confidence in governments in many parts of the world. And then if we see, look at from a different time frame, or a different level rather, here's the system as a whole, confidence in democracy. And in Africa, we see confidence in democracy has stayed more or less constant, Whereas in Latin America, there's been a 10-point decline in confidence in democracy across the last 25 years or so, and as a result of which, barely half of the population on average across Latin America believes that you're better off. Democracy is the best system that's out there, which is quite a dramatic decline. Okay, so that's a very quick tour of our making the case for discontent, these downward trajectories on a number of indicators. Now I'm going to propose our framework for examining it. It's not mind-blowingly complicated by any stretch, but one thing that we were keen to avoid is this kind of, because let's be honest, this is everyone has a theory as to why their country has gone wrong or why people are unhappy. There's a lot out there, and a lot of it sort of falls into the trap of post hoc ergo propter hoc. There is inequality, therefore that must be the cause of discontent, or there is, everyone has their pet theory, and it's very, very hard to really sort of make that link clear. Why does inequality, for example, lead to discontent? And it's not to say it doesn't, but I think, it behoves us as social scientists to try and understand these kind of relationships much better than perhaps is the case. And so our framework is, as I say, not very complicated. It separates three different factors. So you have the spark, which is the immediate cause of visible discontent. And then you have outside that, the grievances, which is the sort of the immediate context. This is the fuel, if you will, for discontent related to day-to-day struggles and injustices. And often these are kind of materially based. And then within these grievances in turn have to be understood within, in terms of the structural factors that are fundamental, how society is organized, imbalances in how power and resources are shared, like these huge questions around the social contract and the relationship citizens have with themselves, the inclusiveness of the economy. These are huge questions, and but they also are, they're very historical. They're infinite. But if you don't try and understand these more structural factors, then any attempt to understand the discontent of the day, or even how a particular protest came about, is always going to be somewhat limited. To give you, the paradigm, or I'm not sure, I never know the right word for this, but the sort of the perfect example of our framework, it's almost too perfect, was provided by the unrest in Chile in October 2019. So, as I'm sure you know, that the protest started because of a very small increase in metro fares. This increase irritated a great deal. The people who used the metro who started avoiding, sort of invaded metro stations, jumped on trains, didn't pay their fares. The police were very heavy-handed. The violence flared and it spread outside the capital of Santiago. Nationwide, and very quickly, the protests were about a lot more than the price of metro fares. One of the things that people were unhappy about was the low value of pensions and the low minimum wage, but especially pensions, which are privately run in Chile and have been delivering a very low retirement income for people for generations, even though the Chilean model is sort of hailed as the shining light of pension reform in the 1990s. So was the question, here I'm asking whether the cause of the El Estallido, it was called, the explosion in Chile, was it the increase in metro fares, or was it the low value of pensions? Or was it the poor quality of public services? So, education and health, people have are very unsatisfied with the quality of those, and also other public services as well. So, high end cost, low end quality. Or the fourth option, is the Pinochet-era constitution. So it was agreed in 1980 while Pinochet was still in charge, and then in 1990 it sort of took effect. And what it did was that constitution sort of set in, even after Pinochet left, it made sure that his economic model, but also his sort of his government's vision for society more broadly, which was extremely sort of market-driven, neoliberal, it kept it in place. It's very difficult for successive governments to change very much. And so, I mean, you can't. This banner is absolutely perfect at the protest. It's not about 30 pesos, which was the increase in metro fares. It's about 30 years. You know, this long-held injustice that was enshrined, codified by the Pinochet-era constitution. And so the answer to the question is, well, all of these were factors behind this explosion, this outburst in violence. But the only way in which Chile could really move forward was by fixing the constitution. So a referendum was held, the population voted overwhelmingly for a new constitution. And then this year, voters were again asked who they would like to write this constitution. And what was fascinating is that they, by and large, voted for political outsiders. No one from only a very small proportion of members of this constituent assembly will come from the mainstream parties, whether they be left or center or right wing. This was a wholesale rejection of a political system, of an economic system, almost of a social system. So this is what we're trying to convey through this framework of the understanding these kind of structural and then the grievances and then the spark, and how the fix often bears absolutely no relation to the spark itself. And but for the record, the president did try and said, okay, we won't raise the cost of the metro and we'll improve pensions, but that wasn't nearly enough. Okay, so these grievances, I'll move quickly through these because they're fairly obvious, but a point I think to start from is that to understand the facts behind